DW Africa Link.
In remote corners of northern Nigeria, a new kind of dialogue is taking shape, one not led by the government, but by local communities themselves. Faced with relentless violence and a state that often feels absent or overwhelmed, village elders are now reportedly negotiating directly with jihadist groups in a desperate bid to restore some form of peace. The negotiations come on the heels of displacements. The village elders want those displaced, like these women, to return home.
They had killed 8 people in Turmi, 4 in Damne, and 3 in Dauku. So how do we come to terms with that? There would not be any reconciliation between us. They should be prosecuted the way they did. They are heartless. They don't listen to our pleas. They would not end well.
We want peace. We want to live peacefully. They abducted my husband and siblings. They have released one of my brothers, but the rest are still with them. They also took my older sister's son. I am here with my sister. They said they are giving aid here. However, they still ask if we need a peace deal, and we said yes, because everyone wants to live peacefully in their homes. We have no peace of mind with our families. If they want to reconcile, we want it. If there is peace, we will be happy. Everyone will live peacefully. Our men used to hide in ceilings, but they got exposed and 50 men got killed.
Now, as a woman, myself and a mother, I understand their plight, and it is disheartening to hear their stories, to say the least. So what happens when citizens turn to militants for security? What role remains for the state? And could these informal pacts reshape governance and authority in one of region's most fragile zones? Today, we are diving into a story where survival, power, and legitimacy collide. That's what's coming up. Stay with us. My name is Josephine Mahachi. Welcome to Africa Link, the podcast that connects you to the stories that matter from and about Africa.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
Communities in northern Nigeria are reportedly engaging in direct negotiations with terror groups after years of failed government efforts to restore peace. But what does this mean for security, governance, and the future of the region? Now, joining me to unpack this is Dengiefa Angalapu, a research analyst at the Center for Democracy and Development. He is a political scientist whose work focuses on development challenges in the global south, particularly climate change, conflict, terrorism, and sustainability. Also with us is DW's correspondent Abiodun Jamiu, reporting from Nigeria. I will start with you, Jamiu, just to give us an overview of what exactly is happening and what has really prompted this decision by the communities in the northern region.
Thank you, Jose. What we are witnessing in northern Nigeria, where local communities are having peace deal negotiating with terrorists or bandits. It's an indictment on the failure of the government to actually perform its basic responsibility, which is the protection of lives and property. In states like Zamfara, Sokoto, we have Niger, Katsina, rural communities continue to live in a state of, in a constant state of fear. Armed groups, because of the multiple of the actors we have in the region, armed groups in the region, just like the jihadists, terrorists, bandits, raid villages, abduct people for ransoms, and even some extent, levy taxes on farming activities and impose curfew. So, in some communities along Sokoto, Katsina, just like Sabon Brene, Issa, we have communities or villages that have been completely abandoned. So others survive by striking fragile. This is where they now, you know, carry out fragile parts, just like you know, mediation efforts with these terrorists. The irony is that the fact that because of the multiple of actors in this region, the fact that they have one peace deal with one camp does not mean that the other camp will not share them from attacks on other camps. So it's a vicious cycle of violence in the Northwest, and what we are currently witnessing have left people helpless so much that they are now having negotiation or taking initiative, like having negotiations, peace deal with terror groups.
Mm-hmm. Now, to you, Dengiefa is our expert today. I mean, from a security standpoint, how do you assess this decision of communities to negotiate with the terror groups?
Thank you so much, first, for having me. It's quite an interesting conversation. I think where we really need to begin, you know, is to ask ourselves, why are communities now involved in peace agreement with bandit terrorist group or non-state violent actors? I think that's the basic point to begin from. And if you interrogate from there, you realize that there are basic agreements in every society. The very first agreement in a society is the agreement between the people and the government. I mean, if you look at social contract theories, they will tell you that, you know, the reason why we have the modern state, why we have the government, it's simply because of a social contract. There was an agreement between the people and then the state for the state to protect them while they, of course, lay and give the state their liberties, freedom, and all of that. So basically, the state is there to protect them. In the modern state system, we elect leaders for leaders to protect them. So it means that there is an agreement. It is the failure of that agreement in the first instance that has made the community members to enter into another agreement. So it is not as though it's a decision that they are making. For me, it is not really even a decision. It's a rational survival calculus with response to the fact that there has been a failure of the first agreement, the first fundamental agreement between the people and the government, between the state and the society. You know, when that agreement has failed, other agreements have now, you know, come in between. So in both Northwest, what I talk about, Borno, or the Northwest in Zamfara, communities have faced brutal choice, either to negotiate or to face extermination. Say, for example, in Zumi LGA in Zamfara and Issa in Sokoto East, villagers have negotiated with bandit groups to pay protection fees, sometimes even handing over their food or fuel to them to ensure that they are able to go to the farm or for them to have peace in the community.
So Dengiefa, with all these attacks, you know, the biggest obviously in Nigeria was the Boko Haram, all those girls that were taken. Are you telling me these communities actually know who these people are?
Communities actually know. In every crime situation, you know, there are people that understand and know these actors. They know these people. If you study the conflict in Nigeria very carefully, whether in Borno, whether in Zamfara, whether in the Northeast generally or the Northwest, or even in the Niger Delta or whatever, or the North Central where you have farmer elder conflict. If you go and ask the community people, they will tell you, I know his father, I know his mother, I know his brother. This person grew up with us. Even Dogo Gide that is so feared in the Northwest, people will tell you, I know his father, I know his mother, I know his uncle. So they actually know these people. They know them. But so it is not so much that they fear them, basically. It is so much that the government has failed to protect them. So they are now vulnerable to these people. So it is not like they don't know them. They actually know these people.
Hmm. And I'm just also thinking, Dengiefa, the long-term implications, you know, of these local deals in terms of national security. Because for any country, you know, national security should be top priority. And obviously, counter-terrorism efforts for countries like Nigeria. Do you feel like this is the right route?
It is very, very complicated. With respect to national security, I think it is something that it's very, very negative. It's something that is very disadvantageous to the country. First off, this means that, you know, there is now some level of parallel governance. You know, so you have the state government and you also have non-state actors competing for governance at a local level. So what it means is that the legitimacy of the citizenry is being divided. So you have some, you know, that respect the state legitimacy, while some with the level of the realities and the brutal killings that they see in the environment will ultimately want to respect the legitimacy of the non-state violent actors that control that particular domain. So that would mean that the legitimacy of the state has been reduced. That is one. The second reality that I think becomes very problematic is the fact that it is difficult for you not to say that, you know, for you to command that or probably discourage people from being recruited into violent gangs. Because what happens is that when these communities negotiated bandits and have peace agreements, you basically legitimize them in some instance. And the result of that is that growing up, children that are growing up, youths, boys, girls, begin to see what these non-state violent actors, whether they are terrorists or bandits or whatever, you know, they begin to see what they do as legitimate. So it is easy now to recruit them into violent gangs. And again, it gives opportunity for these violent non-state actors to convince them. So that you elevate them to now warlords. They bring all sort of ideologies, even though it wasn't there, to tell communities that we are actually fighting for them. This government cannot protect you. So it is, in the long run, it is very, 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 very disadvantageous for national security. In any way you look at it, it is not good for national security.
Mm. And Jamiu, not just to come to you as someone who's been reporting on these security issues in the country for years now, I'm just wondering what specific turning point that led to this end. If you've spoken to any of the community leaders to find out how the negotiations are going and how they're being conducted, are there any intermediaries or direct talks, you know, things like that?
Oh, yes. Most of the time when this negotiation wants to happen, it is usually between local communities and the bandits, particularly for them to just, you know, stop their attacks. And in most instances, it is usually carried out using local communities. In fact, sometimes the right to these bandits. For instance, I can say of in Anka local government, we have Bagega. We know an instance where communities members, you know, go to a farm of a certain warlord to actually farm on his farmland, work in his mine, just to protect, in quote unquote, buy peace. So these are the kind of arrangement that we have in the region. So in several cases, the negotiation, you know, often led to temporary improvements where markets will reopen. You know, farmers can have access to their farmland, and to some extent, the rate of their of kidnapping would decline. So, and like I said earlier on, that the fact that they have negotiation with one camp does not shield them from attack from another camp. So, but the gains are these two. That means the gains that they have, you know, are fragile. The peace are temporal. Sometimes also it's also confirmed by traditional and religious leader when they reach out to these people. So basically, that's how the negotiation is usually arranged.
Mm. And what are the terrorists really like demanding in return for peace or protection?
Most time, it's usually sometimes in time of getting them motorcycles. Another time, it's maybe by getting them fuel or working on their farms. In fact, there are times where they would demand food stuff from local communities. Also, they also ask for money to, you know, guarantee passage or allow farming activities. So these are some of the things that they demand for. So sometimes they demand for the dismantlement of what we call it, these local volunteer groups like the Young Sakai. So they always oftentimes also demand the dismantling of such a non-star security outfit that protect the communities.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dingiefa, let's talk about governance, you know, governance structures. I feel like this is like breaking protocol. That's just my opinion, right, in terms of governing the country. And could this idea lead to a fragmentation of authority, or rather maybe parallel governance structures in the country?
It is already happening. Now, if you take that to the Northwest and the Northeast, where you have banditry and terrorism, it is already happening. These non-state actors are setting up, you know, mediation centers. They are setting up a task collection system. And then even though you are able to defeat this criminality, this crime rate, you're able to finish the insurgency, you are going to be dealing with dismantling governance system that I've already put in place. And you don't know who has bought into that ideology. So it is a very fundamental challenge. So parallel governance is already happening. There are some places where, and if you read the literature, you realize the fact that there are places where in Nigeria, it is called ungoverned spaces. These places are not governed by the government. They are rather governed by non-state actors. And then, again, this is a very, very important point that I need to make. We call this guerrilla warfare asymmetric warfare. So we say the bandit attack and then they go, terrorist attack and then they go. What we actually do not really, really simplify is the fact that the government approach is also some form of guerrilla or asymmetric approach. So they come to the community, protect the community, chase the bandits out, and then they go. But then who is nearer to the people with respect to either protection or with respect to meting out violence in the community? It is still the bandits. So the army finishes their work in the community. Sometimes they chase them out and they record their wins and then they go back to base. But the bandits live among the people. The terrorists live among the people. They live in nearby bushes. So it is easy for them to enforce governance on these people. You know, so there are different governance structures, you know, that exist in Nigeria that are now introduced by non-state actors. So I think it's very, very problematic. And this parallel governance system will definitely compete with the governance system of modern Nigeria. What makes it very worse is when community members begin to see that the justice that they do not see in the, for example, the national justice system, you know, they see within minutes or within seconds in the justice system controlled by the bandits or the terrorists. It means that they now begin to see that, okay, perhaps maybe the justice system of this particular bandit group or this particular terrorist group or non-state actor is better than the court system that the government has instituted, especially because maybe some of them have spent several years complaining to the police, complaining to the state authorities, but yet nothing has been done. But probably when they go to the non-state actors, whether by violence or whatever means, some kind of decision is being made, they will respect that system. So that parallel system is already in place. And I think that it is something that will disturb the country for quite a long time till we deal with it.
And I'm just wondering, is the country leaders, the government, I mean, President Bola Ahmed Tinubu himself and his team, not worried about even these, community leaders and the terrorists coming together? I'm just painting a picture here of the communities feeling like, you know what, if we can work together and this government is not doing anything about this, you know, like even just to, I don't know, to dismantle the country. With the way even Biodun yourself, you're explaining how these community leaders are dealing with the terror groups. This is a security breach, or is it not, Dengefa?
It is a very, very serious security breach. And in fact, what happens, the implication of this is that community members now become some kind of accessories to this bandit or terrorist group. I mean, they give information to bandit groups. And then sometimes when even the security agencies are coming to attack them, they are the first to inform the bandits that security members and security officials are coming, you know. So, but then it is a decision for survival. It's a decision for survival. I believe the government is worried about it, but then the government does not just need to worry. They need to match words with action and action with words. So it means that they need to reclaim community trust. And how do you reclaim community trust? You have to come back and then reclaim your position as that sovereign security provider. If communities see, for example, that the police system, that the security system can protect them, I mean, they are rational human beings. They know and they can decide, you know, who has more power with respect to protecting them and who can arm them more. They know. So it is a rational choice that they've made with respect to collaborating with bandits. It is not as though they like the bandits. It is a matter of survival. It is what they can do to survive at the moment. So if the security agencies and the government can actually come, win the trust of the communities and bring back the level of security and confidence of the community that the security agencies can protect them, I trust you, the communities will delink from the bandits and then transfer their confidence back to the security agencies. So the government is very worried. But I think that the government is also in a dilemma now, and they've allowed the situation to deteriorate to a very large extent that some communities do not even trust them. Because what happens sometimes is that government forces might come and then lodge out these bandits, and then the bandits will come and then, you know, have a reprisal attack on the community and ask them, who informed the security agencies that we are actually here, or we are attacking here, or we are operating here? I know that kind of a thing. It is a very, very difficult situation where the government cannot protect you, and then the bandits are also attacking you. So you become very, very political. So it is a very dicey situation. It's a situation that communities should never, ever, ever have entered into. It's a very frustrating situation for the communities.
Now, Jamiu, just to attend to you here to find out how the local leaders and residents are reacting to these, you know, arrangements, and if you've seen that some of these negotiations have led to any tangible changes in security or just daily life, you know, in the northern community of Nigeria, and if there's any role you've seen the traditional rulers or religious leaders are playing in these talks as well.
We were at IDPs today to even speak with internally displaced person on what they mean, what they want, or what peace means for them, and what they think about the mediation efforts in these communities by local leaders. It's a painful compromise, to be honest. Many leaders and residents feel conflicted. On one hand, they want peace and are willing to negotiate for it. And on the other hand, they resent being forced into this situation because it's definitely something that they do not want. They want peace. I spoke with one particular woman that lost her husband and even like two kids. She's currently in an internally displaced camp, but she has no choice. She has no choice but to say she wants peace.
We want peace. We want to live peacefully. They abducted my husband and siblings. They had released one of my brothers, but the rest are still with them. They also took my older sister's son. I am here with my sister. They said they are giving aid here. However, they still ask if we need a peace deal, and we said yes, because everyone wants to live peacefully in their homes. We have no peace of mind with our families. If they want to reconcile, we want it. If there is peace, we will be happy. Everyone will live peacefully. Our men used to hide in ceilings, but they got exposed and 50 men got killed. We want help and peace.
And Dengiefa, your final thought as well as we wrap up our discussion, what's the one thing you believe must happen now to prevent further deterioration in the northern part of Nigeria?
For me, really, finally, I would say that we should see communities as being vulnerable. So it is not as though they want to have these peace agreements. It is an act of necessity. It's an act of survival. And if there is something that we must do, we have to strengthen the state capacity to protect these communities. We often say that there is no price too much to pay for peace. And I think this is the kind of mentality that communities now have, and they are paying their prices in several ways. It is not as though these agreements are favorable to them. Their lands are taken, you know, a lot of things are done to them, you know, but then they feel that even a little peace is better than the kind of violence that they see. So I think that the social contract between the state and the people must work. For the social contract between the people and the non-state actors to fail. I will repeat that because it's very, very important. The social contract between the people and the state must work for the social contract between the people and non-state violent actors, to fail. Because if the social contract between the state and the people fails, right, they will have no other option to seek for survival in the most available space. And the available space in this regard, most unfortunately, is the non-state actors that fill that void.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dengiefa Angalapu and Abiodun Jamiu, for your time and insights. Well, this is a conversation that must continue, not just in studios, but in policy rooms and community halls across the region. That's it for this edition of Africa Link. Remember, you are not just a listener, but a crucial part of our community. Your voice matters, and your engagement helps shape the conversations we bring to you. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And remember, you can find all of our Africa Link podcast episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts from. This episode was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabi. My name is Josephine Mahachi. Thanks for listening. And until the next time, it's bye for now.
DW. Made for Minds.